Welcome, everyone, to the Hum in the Silence, Volume 16. Today, I've got some more obscure abductions for you, along with an interesting article that was written about John Mack and his work. Here we will have the Harry Joe Turner story that I promised you at the beginning of this week's episode. The first one I briefly mentioned in our Year of the Humanoid sightings, I managed to find the original newspaper article for the abduction of Clarence Patterson. Patterson was abducted with his truck near Locksley, Alabama, on the evening of October 17th, 1973. Here is the article in full, as I've been able to grab it from the Pensacola News. A Pensacola businessman says he and his truck were swooped up by an unidentified flying object on Interstate 10 last night, heading the list of hundreds of UFO sightings in Northwest Florida, South Alabama area law enforcement officials said today. Many of the reported sightings could be cleared up, however, by helicopter maneuvers in Mobile, atmospheric testing in Eglin Air Force Base, or a weather research balloon floating low in northern Santa Rosa County near Jay. But the alleged abduction could not. Clarence Ray Patterson told Police Sergeant Lucian Mitchell that he was returning to Pensacola from Mobile on Interstate 10 last night when a UFO swooped him up and his truck near the Locksley exit. Patterson, an electrician, told Mitchell that the creatures examined him for about 30 minutes before releasing him on State Road 297 just outside Pensacola. According to the police report filled out on the incident, the first known written report filed here on UFO sightings, Patterson first noticed an unidentified spaceship hovering over his pickup truck. He continued to say that this object hovered over his pickup truck and then pulled the vehicle inside the spaceship, Mitchell said. He related to Mitchell that once inside the ship, he was taken out of his truck by approximately six strange-looking creatures. The description given of the creatures was vague. However, it was similar to other reports, such as the Mississippi incident, where two fishermen were pulled inside a spaceship, Mitchell said. The inhabitants were described as short, with claw-like arms. Patterson said during the examination the inhabitants seemed to be reading his mind. He said they kept him inside the ship for approximately 30 minutes, and during that time, he was taken from Locksley to State Road 297 in Escambia County. He said that he was released unharmed, then drove to Pensacola, where he immediately notified city police. Patterson became very emotional and started crying. He told me that I thought he was some kind of nut and that he would refuse to tell this story again to anyone. I might add, when Patterson was relating this incident to me, he was very nervous. He said from the beginning of the interview that no one would believe him, Mitchell said. Mitchell and other officers said that Patterson was not under the influence of any type of drugs or alcohol. The report was made by Sergeant Mitchell after the police department and the sheriff's office received numerous complaints about unidentified flying objects. I might add that I didn't see any, Mitchell said. But other area law enforcement officers apparently did. Between 3:40 and 5 a.m. today, at least seven Escambia deputies reported seeing UFOs hovering south of Pensacola Beach, according to a resident who monitored a police band radio. It could not be immediately confirmed if these sightings could be accounted for by testing at Eglin Air Force Base between Pensacola and Fort Walton Beach. But many of the reported sightings were more explained. From Jay, a UFO reported to Escambia Sheriff's Department by several residents, was identified as a weather research balloon. And Eglin Air Force Base, in the wake of hundreds of UFO sightings, reissued an advisory about tests test personnel there are conducting. Tests that temporarily discolor the atmosphere and may appear to be bright lights in the sky. Sure. Okay, that seems a little convenient for my skeptical brain. In Mobile, Coast Guard helicopters on mock emergency maneuvers, using spotlights as well as their customary blinking identification lights, caused more than a score of motorists to report UFO sightings. The Mobile situation was worsened when a television station there, acting on the advice of an alleged psychic, announced it would set up cameras on Interstate 10 near the Mississippi border to film UFOs. More than 1,000 cars followed the TV crew, and a massive traffic jam ensued. Weather research balloons have prompted a new rash of reports of unidentified flying objects throughout the South, and UFO bugged authorities are bracing for more reports today and Friday. At least two offices of the National Weather Service reported separate launchings of weather balloons Wednesday. A huge balloon, 150 feet in diameter, was launched at Palestine, Texas, and authorities say it drifted off over Mississippi at a constant 50,000-foot altitude. The Weather Service at Montgomery, Alabama, also reported launching a balloon with an altitude reaching about 85,000 feet. Many of the sightings occurred after the sun had gone down, but a spokesman at the National Weather Service in Macon, Georgia, explained the sun's light would reflect off the balloon long after dusk because of the high altitude of the object. Meanwhile, officials at Eglin have announced high atmospheric rocket tests today and Friday and cautioned that rockets could easily be mistaken for UFOs. Air Force officials said the rockets would release glowing clouds of red, green, blue, and yellow gases. A spokesman said the colors in the sky will be visible as far south as Miami, as far west as Corpus Christi, Texas, as far north as Memphis, Tennessee, and along the eastern seaboard of Charlesse. The rockets will be launched at two-hour intervals beginning at 5:30 p.m. CDT today and continue through Friday night, the spokesman added. Despite official explanations, residents in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina continued to inundate local sheriff's offices with reports of UFOs. Troopers said they had reports of UFOs at Dothan, Troy, Birmingham, Gadsden, and Tuscaloosa. In Mississippi, objects were sighted over Jackson and Yazoo City. In Georgia, the objects were spotted over Atlanta, Athens, Rome, and Macon. Greenville, South Carolina, authorities were swamped with calls from individuals who said they saw an unexplained object in the sky. Sheriff Fred Diamond of Jackson County, Mississippi, called for a federal investigation of the recent UFO sightings in the South. He said, "People down here are entitled to know what is going on. People are beginning to panic." So, Fred Diamond, he was the sheriff involved in the Pascagoula abduction. So, you know, he was witness to a lot of this stuff. Here's what the Year of the Humanoids report had to say about abduction cases in 1973. Quote, 1973 had an unprecedented number of 8 reported abductions of witnesses by humanoid beings. Even more remarkable was the fact that 6 of these occurred during the fall, wave, and all 6 during the month of October, the peak month of the wave. All 6 bore some striking similarities, including physical examinations of the witnesses with one another and with older cases. 5 of the 6 occurred in the United States. These facts, taken at face value, imply that a systematic study of a human population sample and of a limited geographic area was made during the fall of 1973. And what you're going to find later on when we cover Bud Hopkins basically starts parroting the same stuff. He's basically saying, oh, this is a systematic scientific study of human beings. And then you're going to find out exactly what he turns it into. I am a, you know, big critic of the man, but furthermore, it would appear that this type of bold behavior by the UFO entities is becoming more common. I have recorded 50 abduction cases dating back to 1942, and have again as many which I call possible abductions, i.e., the witness does not recall being abducted, but a period of missing time or memory loss is involved. Over half of the abduction cases, and most of the possible abductions, have occurred during the 70s. Although the recognition of potential abduction cases and the use of regressive hypnosis to recover potentially repressed information from UFO witnesses has only recently become a standard procedure, it seems that this type of encounter is on the increase and may signal a new phase of the UFO phenomenon. End quote. And again, we're going to be touching on a lot of this with the Bud Hopkins episodes. I'm just realizing now how much he modeled a lot of his research off of this, because it is, there's a lot to do. There's a lot of similarities there. And speaking of the idea of possible abductions, an article entitled "New Wrinkle in Abduction Cases" was published in the April Bulletin in 1982. And this is an interesting article, so I'm going to read it for y'all. An article in March 1982 edition of the National Enquirer pointed out the possibility that there may exist a proliferation of latent abduction cases, i.e. reports of UFO abductions which have not come to light because the abductee is unaware of the experience. Now, this is what Mike Clellan calls the maybe people. Very same concept here. APRO's address was given as an agency which suspected abductees could contact, which resulted in a literal flood of letters. Most of the letters are interesting, many from people who had experienced dreams about UFOs, unusual interest in UFOs, etc. One of the more interesting letters came from a woman in a western state. We are withholding her identity and location to protect her from unwanted mail, telephone calls, and curiosity seekers in general. However, the general gist of her experience and that of her companions is as follows. Quote, "I know I was in a UFO," she writes. "The time was July 2nd, 1953 or 1954. I was on vacation in Oregon, along with my mother, brother, sister, two daughters, and stepdaughter, and two nephews." She then goes on to say that small events from the trip have been coming back to her, and she has discussed them with her mother on occasion. Her brother has the conviction that from the time their group entered the place until they left and were well on the road, they were probably quote-unquote programmed. The lady was driving on US 97 in Oregon and had noted that the gas gauge showed that the car was getting low on gas, so she was watching for a cafe or a gas station. They were driving in hills about 10 miles south of the 97-138 junction and came around a bend in the road and saw a big round-shaped restaurant all lit up. As soon as the car got close, the engine sputtered and stopped, whereupon they coasted into the, quote, beautiful covered parking area, end quote, where three or four other cars were parked. The place had exceptionally bright lights, Mrs. R. said, and when they entered the building, they found themselves in a circular enclosure where everything was well lit, very bright, and the walls seemed like mirrors. The group sat at a table of a kind she had never seen before. It appeared to be made of glass or plexiglass. After they were seated, the children all decided to go to the restrooms and left the table. Mrs. R.'s brother, Cliff, beckoned to his sister to come over to where he was standing and looking into another room. The two looked into a big round room and said it appeared as if it was going to be made into a cocktail lounge or dance floor. It was a huge round room with lots of windows around it, about 2 feet from the ceiling. The family did not remember having seen the restaurant before and assumed it was a new establishment just being built up close to the summit of the peak they were driving to. They were, at the time, southeast of Crater Lake, Oregon. The people in the restaurant were all blonde and petite, and Mrs. R recalls that they all looked alike. She does not recall any conversation, but it seemed that they all ordered and ate a meal. The waiter and waitress at their table were about 4 feet 2 inches tall and slender. All of the people in the establishment were wearing silver uniforms and boots, the latter of which had black trim of some kind around the edges of the soles, and the heels were black. There was an emblem on the front of the boot, but she does not remember specifically what it was. Mrs. R. remembers telling her mother that the place was really unbelievable, and asked the waitress where she got the uniform, and the girl answered. But she, Mrs. R., does not recall what she said. Mrs. R. recalls that the voices of the people she talked with were soft and musical. Mrs. R. says she recalls picking up their ticket and going to a round-shaped cage-type place to pay the bill. The group then left and got in the car, which didn't start but sort of coasted out to the highway. She also remembers her mother telling her that they had better find a gas station as soon as possible. Partway down the hill, as they went around a curve, the car started by itself. She discovered she had over half a tank of gas, so she decided that they could drive into Chestnut and gas up there. When they arrived at the intersection connecting with the Crater Lake Road, State 138, there were two snowplows and a truck. Workmen were plowing out the road to the lake and told Mrs. R. and her family that they had to have it open for the 4th of July traffic. She asked one of the men when the new big cafe had been built up on the top of the hill, about 8 or 10 miles away, and the man looked at her, quote, as if I was nuts or something, end quote. She explained that they had just stopped and eaten there and asked how far it was to the nearest gas station. The man said it was about 10 miles to Chenault. When they arrived at Chenault, all the children got out of the car and ran to the restrooms, and Mrs. R.'s stepdaughter pointed out that she had left her purse at the restaurant. After they had gassed up, they all got back into the car and headed back to the cafe. Mrs. R. drove back along the route, but when they got to where she thought the restaurant was located, they couldn't find it. Her brother suggested that perhaps she had taken the wrong road, but Mrs. R. explains that there was no other road. They drove on for some distance, but never did find the cafe, so they drove on back to Chenault. When they arrived at Chenault, the snowplows they had seen earlier at the junction were parked there, and the men were in the cafe. The family stopped and ate, but every time they tried to mention the cafe up on the summit, the people gave them strange looks, and when they left, the people seemed glad to see them leave. That's brutal. Mrs. R. says she is sure that she and her family were in a UFO. It didn't register with her at the time, but occasionally since, she and her mother, especially, have discussed the strange experience. Then about 2 years ago, when she brought up the subject to her mother said, "Yes, I remember, but sometimes when I think of it now, I have a funny feeling, like maybe we were a surprise to them, the people in the cafe." This one incident allegedly took place about 28 or 29 years ago. Mrs. R. is now 61 years of age, her mother is 82, the brother 44, the daughters 39, 41, and 42. Her sister is 39 and a nephew is 35 or 36. The other nephew is deceased. Mrs. R. says that the recall really started in about 1969, and she had discussed the incident in great detail, as much as possible, with her mother, one daughter, and her brother. Details have become clearer with the passage of time. She had been back to the area several times, but has never found anything which would account for their experience. She also remembers that after visiting the cafe and arriving at Chenault, she found she had the same amount of money she had before the visit to the cafe and concluded that they hadn't stopped anywhere. Obviously, a considerable amount of investigation is ahead of us on this case. We have presented it here because of the radical departure from known descriptions of other similar cases. End quote. If you recall on episode 115, I mentioned that the Zhao Klein case was discovered during the investigation of a case involving a man named Paulo Coutinho. In this episode, in this segment, we're going to cover that case, and it's a pretty fascinating one. On the night of June 23rd, 1976, Paulo Coutinho, 37 years old, was taking night classes at a nearby school. He lived in Sao Paulo, in a neighborhood known as Aricanduva. He had left his home around 6:45 p.m., stopping by his girlfriend's house, who studied at the same school, the State College of Villa Aricanduva, Zalin Roca, or Rocha. They walked together and arrived at 7:25 p.m. In class that day, he had a particularly grueling math test. He was normally a D student, but on this test he scored an A. Both he and his girlfriend left the school around 11:30 p.m., dropping her off at home and heading to his place, which took him through Moses Mark Street, reaching it at around 11:45 p.m. Paulo Coutinho was not seen again until 20 hours later. What I find interesting is, like, a lot of UFO witnesses in Brazil, in particular, they seem to be taking night classes. So I find that to be interesting, because Antonio Vias Boas was as well. His father was worried sick, but in the early evening hours of the next day, Paulo Coutinho was found next to his house, downcast and talking about being taken on board a UFO. As he recounted the events, he was walking in an east-west direction 4 minutes after leaving his girlfriend. A white light caught his attention. He stopped and watched the light and noticed that it was getting closer, much closer, closing in on him fast. Paulo tried to run away from it, but found that he couldn't. He was unable to move, no matter how hard he tried. His limbs would not move. His eyes were the only thing he could move, and he closed his eyes in response to the bright light. It came so fast, it came so close, that he was finally able to make out its shape. It was spherical, just 2 meters or 6.5 feet in diameter. It changed to an orange-colored hue until the light disappeared completely 3 minutes later. Gradually, the figure of a little person appeared, less than a foot tall. Their head was abnormally large for their size and bald. Their eyes were big, but proportional to the size of the head, but were comparable to a human eye. The being had an upturned nose and subtle mouth. The sketch of these beings is so, so interesting. I'll share it in the... I usually attach images on the... on these episodes, so you will be seeing those in the post. Paulo was paralyzed, able to move only his head a little bit. He could see that his body was drifting upward, and the being was moving up with him. They moved faster and faster, the earth falling away behind him. Paulo felt like he was in space, fast approaching a long, sparkling, red cigar-shaped object. So this is interesting. Paulo literally thinks that he is in space, drifting in space towards this object, which is very unique. Normally, if it's like an out-of-body experience, they're drifting up toward the UFO. It's still on Earth, but like he's in space right now. But if you look at the sketch of this craft, it looks like a finger. That's the best way to describe it. Paulo became very dizzy, blacking out briefly. He woke up inside a square room that was light gray in color. Next to Paulo stood two short beings. They had very similar features to the one he ascended with, but differed slightly in height. He tried to reassure himself of the experience he was having, and desperately wanted to touch the beings, but still, he could not move. A message ran through his mind. We are not going to do anything to you. So, 2, don't try anything against us. Paolo could now feel freedom in his movements a little. The little beings beckoned him to follow, and the being that had brought him on board accompanied him on his right. The central portion of the nearby wall fell away, leaving a 2-meter or 6.5-foot gap through which they passed into a much larger room. A group of 6 more beings met them in this room, one of whom was leaning against a wall. This being produced a similar gap in the far wall, but Paolo was asked to remain here. He decided to sit, giving his strained muscles a break. His thoughts drifted to his girlfriend and other earthen comforts. In response, a screen came to life showing 3-dimensional images of him and his girlfriend walking earlier that day. The image changed to 2 of his classmates from school, who were on a motorcycle chasing a party balloon. Then again, the image shifted to one of his parents, whom he remembered then. His father was pacing back and forth, while his mother was crying. Paolo turned to the beings who were with him and asked them, revolted in Portuguese, loud and clear, "What do you want with me?" As if it were an answer, this idea appeared in the boy's mind. "Take it easy. We won't hurt you." Paolo then asked them why they are here on Earth, and they replied, "We are studying how life arose on the planets and in the universe. We are also here to help." He asked them if God existed, and they said yes. Then an image of Americans and Russians working together in space appeared on the screen. Paolo also asked the ship's crew if the degree of terrestrial technology was good. He was mentally answered, "If all the countries of the planet united their efforts in common, the result would have a much greater reach." Whenever the beings responded to his questions, accompanying images would appear on the screen. To Paolo's question, "Why don't extraterrestrials descend en masse on Earth?" it was explained to him as follows, quote, "As long as the terrestrial globe remained divided, such a gesture would provoke a war, which the extraterrestrials wanted to avoid. They could come down en masse to help, but only when Earth was a single unit, because they didn't want to get involved in factions. There were still millions of planets with life, where they also did their research." End quote. The being that had been with Paolo the entire time walked over to the being leaning against the wall, and they proceeded to stare at each other for only a few minutes before Paolo's guide placed their hand on a device on the wall. An opening appeared in it. A female being on board walked into a corridor and was bathed in reddish light after she passed through the wall, closed again. Moments later, she reappeared with another being. Shortly after, Paolo was guided through to the previous room, where he knelt inside a dark gray circle. A slab table came out of the wall, and Paolo's body floated up and into it. The newest alien in the room walked over to Paolo and began running a hand over his body. His hair stood on end as the doctor went up one side and down the other. When the doctor was completed with their task, they left the room. The table re-entered the wall, and Paolo was once again on his knees in the gray circle. Quote, "Then Paolo felt a strong pressure, coming from all sides, as if they were crushing him. Soon after, he found himself thrown out of the room and also outside of the ship. Side by side with his guide, the boy floated through space. Both passed over the flying object in the shape of a cigar. Again, it looks like a finger. Which took about 4 to 5 seconds, according to Paolo's calculations. A student also reported that, at the moment, he felt dizzy and his vision became blurred. He was seized by a strong dizziness and saw a whirlwind of lights. What happened afterwards, he remembers nothing more. The passage of time was different. He felt like he'd only been gone for a short period of time, but when he got back, the next evening, He awoke on a step at the back of the house in an external corridor that led to a vegetable garden. Quote, at about that time, Mr. Jose Cotino had glanced at a neighbor's kitchen above the butte that surrounds a small backyard and vegetable garden at the back of the house. As he immediately informed his wife and other children, Coutinho's and Eduardo, at that moment, he received a mental warning that Paulo would reappear. From then on, his uneasiness regarding the fate of his missing son ceased to exist. So, it's interesting that the beings kind of reassure him when his son is going to be returned. I mean, that's pretty cool. Like, they could have warned him ahead of time, but, you know, that is what it is. In a letter to SBEDV, Mr. Jose Coutinho explained that he also had numerous doubts related to the case. He says he jumped the backyard wall, which was 1.60 meters high, several times. And continuing, he says, I noticed that I left my hands with some dirt and marks on the wall of rustic construction, and nothing of that was in Paulo's hands, which was verified by me. He also added that in the conditions in which Paulo found himself, speechless, semi-fainted, he was unable to jump the aforementioned wall. There was no response to the question to Paulo made by Mr. Joseph. What's going on, my son? Mr. Jose turned his son's belly up and noticed that the boy's skin was cold and had purple spots. Furthermore, he noted that the boy's breathing was labored. Sitting his son on the floor again, Paulo slipped into the lying position. With the help of others, the student was carried to a chair in the kitchen. There too, left unsupported, he slammed to the ground. So, you know, that's nice. Your parents coming over to give you a hand and they just, like, let your limp body fall on the ground. That's great. Paulo was taken to bed. Mr. Jose wanted to communicate with his son, though all attempts failed. He wanted to find out about what the boy had suffered. Maybe a kidnapping, so he could help him better. Again, they sat Paulo down, leaning on the bed. They placed a notebook in front of him and thrust a pencil between his fingers. However, he appeared not to have enough strength to write. He just stared. He just started a movement, but soon the pencil stopped. One of the girls present had the idea of holding his hand and pushing it towards the paper in order to facilitate some possible communication for Paulo. In this way, the student even scribed these words in the notebook. My body tingling. His mother inspected his clothes and found a black powder in the folds. Soon after, policemen showed up to take him to the emergency room, though he had already shown signs of improvement. When he was discharged, he was still weak and needed help walking. His condition was slow to improve, but he eventually made a full recovery. So now we come to the story of Harry Joe Turner. It's an interesting one, and he's a really interesting person. He was a Navy veteran, a truck driver by trade, an amateur boxer with 24 fights under his belt, and according to the April Bulletin, he had donated 27 pints of blood in his 28 years. So, you know, he's a blood donor, too. You know, I respect that. On the evening of August 28th, 1979, Harry pulled out of Bigman's restaurant in Winchester, Virginia, and stopped briefly at a gasoline station about a block away. It was 10:52 p.m., and with a fresh soda in the cup holder, he set out for Fredericksburg on a brand new route. Quote, there was a little lightning and stuff. But the strangest thing was there was hardly no cars on the road. Everything just seemed deserted, end quote. 17 miles into the trip, just past Paris Mountain, he observed the lights of an approaching truck in the distance. The lights of Harry's truck started to blink on and off. The CB screeched loudly, and Harry did what he could to shield one of his ears. Then it was like a beam of light settled over his truck. The steering wheel no longer responded when he turned the wheel. Quote, "It was like the whole truck was just floating, like it was being vacuumed up into this thing. I don't know what to call those things, but one of them opened the door and there was another on the roof." Harry felt a tremendous pain on his shoulder as one of them, one of these beings, grabbed him. In turn, Harry grabbed his .32 caliber revolver, pushed the barrel to his left until he felt resistance, and then he fired 8 rounds. Got that Ed Walters kind of pluck about him. Quote, "The gun just seemed to move right through the thing. Nothing happened, and then I started to fade out." End quote. Turner woke up in the passenger seat, which had arrived at the warehouse in Fredericksburg. He had no memory of how he got there, and when he looked over to the driver's side, he was startled to find that the seatbelt was fastened, and there were 8 shell casings on the floor mat. The warehouse clock indicated that it was 3 a.m., though he found that his own watch had stopped at 11:17. The oddest detail, though, is that Harry had only traveled 17 miles of an 80-mile journey. But oddly, he had consumed 114 gallons of fuel, which is allegedly enough to make the 160-mile round trip at least 3 times. Like, fuel efficiency here, aliens. Come on. In the weeks that followed, Turner started to recall more details of what had happened during the encounter. He and his truck were taken 6.8 light years to a strange place beyond Alpha Centauri. Quote, "My best recollection is that they were like you or me, only they were dressed in white clothes like a surgeon. They wore white caps, and when they lifted up the fronts, there were numbers on their heads. They wanted to help us, but they say things have gone pretty far here, and the end is coming soon." End quote. At one point, he recalled punching a few of the aliens. As you do, like, you know, that's the... Travis Walton did the same thing, pretty much. Naturally, Harry went through a lot of changes following his encounter, and here are some of my favorite quotes from the APRO Bulletin. Quote, "He claims the Space Odyssey, which allegedly took him 2.5 light years beyond Alpha Centauri, destroyed his nerves. He has to rely on sedatives. He seems to be gaining bionic strength in his right arm, and he has a craving for such things as bananas, coconut, and deer meat, items he never liked before. I never used to read anything but the Winchester Evening Star and Hustler magazine." Now, he goes through a variety of magazines, periodicals, and religious literature with lightning speed. "The only trouble is that I have to do a lot of reading twice, once for them and once for me. They're using my left eye to learn about the planet, I think." Since his experience, Turner has been unable to work. He has sought psychiatric and neurological help in an effort to understand what happened to him. He has only partial use of his left side, and most frightening, he has been revisited by the aliens on at least 2 occasions. 2 nights after his encounter, Turner was lying in bed. He looked over to his wife, and suddenly he could see her skeleton as if he had X-ray vision. Basically, this is Turner's superhero origin story. He is Superman now. Nobody can stop him. He is unstoppable. "Ever since it all began, I've just been sitting here going over and over in my mind trying to piece things back together. I'd feel pretty good if I could figure out where I've been." And that's the story of Harry Joe Turner. It's an interesting one. This final piece is an article about Dr. John Mack. In the July 1994 edition of Omni magazine, there appeared an article by Anita Baskin entitled "UFO Update. A Harvard psychiatrist says alien encounters, while traumatic, may be our gateway to God." Here is the article in full. For the past 3 decades, students of UFO abduction have hailed from outside the scientific community. Their ranks include a historian, a social worker, and an artist. Despite the diversity of their backgrounds, these researchers have all agreed on one thing. The aliens, they say, are evil, inflicting on their human victims only misery and pain. But now, Dr. John E. Mack, professor of psychiatry at Cambridge Hospital, an affiliate of the Harvard Medical School, and a Pulitzer Prize winner, has broken the mold. The first world-class scientist to jump on the abduction bandwagon, Mack agrees that alien abductions do, indeed, take place. But unlike other researchers, he says the abduction experience can be spiritually uplifting, a key to inner growth. To back up his theories, Mack has recently published Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens, Scribners, the chronicle of 8 male and 5 female abductees whose stories have been elicited through hypnosis. The tales they tell, say Mack, who has worked with 80 abductees in all, reveal many examples of great personal growth, a re-experiencing of past lives, and a deepening concern for the fate of the Earth. Joe Noonan, for instance, is a 34-year-old psychotherapist who runs a professional development and training business. As quoted in Mack's book, Noonan says his alien abductors are midwives who help him stay connected to his divinity. Unconditional acceptance and understanding are always an integral part of my ET experiences, Noonan explains. Eva, a mother of 2, says that for her, abduction has been a process of awakening. The aliens need us for their own reasons, she says, but they are also helping us to evolve as a race. But if aliens connect us with the cosmic realm, why do they cause us so much pain? It's possible, says Mack, that the alien presence, however traumatic, may be part of a larger process bringing us back to our common source. But most of Mack's fellow investigators put little stock in his ideas. I haven't seen the positive spiritual components that John Mack reports, says piece of shit David Jacobs, an historian at Temple University and author of the book Secret Life, a shitty book, a step-by-step examination of the abduction process. Most abductees don't like this phenomenon, feel that it's a detriment to their lives, wish that it never happened to begin with, and hope it never happens again. And, like, I don't want to downplay anybody's trauma, but goddamn, like, what a fucking fearmonger. Many abductees also vehemently disagree with Mack's findings. According to Wendy, a food manufacturer who says she has been repeatedly abducted, I've been forsaken by God, not enlightened by him. Why isn't he answering my prayers and stopping this? Adds Sheila, a 32-year-old mother of 3. Saying I benefited spiritually from being abducted by aliens is like saying an Auschwitz survivor benefited spiritually from being treated like a laboratory animal. And she went there. And how do Mack's colleagues in psychiatry feel about his abduction research? John O'Brien, CEO of the Cambridge Hospital, has only praise. John, he says, is a nationally recognized clinician and researcher, and we encourage him to pursue his interests, whatever they are. As for the American Psychiatric Association, it does not endorse Mack's work. But Dr. Michael S. Aronoff, spokesperson for the New York County District Branch, says the association generally views any responsible scientific research into human behavior as useful for the progress of information. End quote. And that's going to do it for this installment of The Hum in the Silence. Thank y'all so much for subscribing to us on Patreon, helping us foot the bills, which, you know, they're more than you think they are. Thank you so much for listening. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the theme for this podcast, and to Megan Lagerberg for our logo. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or near the exit to Locksley, Alabama. In Gray, we trust.